Welcome to episode 86 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week's topic is Abe Sapien, The Devil Does Not Jest, and other stories. And now, the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another derpy episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hey!
And Jen.
Hello!
And this week we read Abe Sapien, The Devil Does Not Jest, and other stories.
Other stories?
So I have to say, in reading a lot of comics, we've seen plenty of derpy faces. We've seen Derpy Horse. We've seen other derpy stuff. But I think the derpiest face I've ever seen was on the monster in The Devil Does Not Jest. The wife that gets transformed, the first time I see her, she's supposed to be scary, I think. Because she's got this giant fucking arm, but instead her eyeballs are just facing the wrong fucking direction.
It was just, that was sad.
I know this is a weird place to start, but I just couldn't help it. It's been on my mind the entire time.
You must be talking about this page.
Yes, that page. Every time she shows up, she just got this frown in her eyeballs.
Yeah, look, the guy on the Sal's derping along with her.
Yeah. It's a little derpy, that series of issues. But first, actually, I should say, these are all written by Mike Mignola and co-written by other people.
Oh, okay.
But at least it's like story by Mike Mignola, at the least, you know. And I think most of them are drawn by, well, not they're not all drawn by the same person, but most of them are colored by Dave Stewart. And I want to, see, there's a bunch of different artist credits, but they're all colored by Dave Stewart. Right, and I want to mention this because we got tweeted at by Mark Tweedale. Why are you still looking at me like that?
You're talking. I'm active listening.
We got tweeted at by Mark Tweedale. I think that's how he wants me to say it. And he corrected us and said that actually, because last week we mentioned how much we liked the coloring, and we credited the artist, but we didn't credit the colorist.
Ooh.
And apparently he's won multiple Eisners for his work on BPRD, so we should actually go back and give him credit for that.
Indeed.
Give him credit for these, too, because coloring here is pretty good as well. Actually, did he color next week as well? Sorry, Dave. Sorry. We know you're a listener. Actually, be fucking sick.
I mean, we genuinely are sorry.
Yes.
We try to credit things correctly, but we're not that organized.
No.
Nope.
And nor do we like doing research. In advance or anything.
I mean, it's not that hard because it's right here in the trade.
But we're pretty lazy, so.
I guess we're not as good at reading as we'd like people to think in a podcast about reading.
And, you know, this actually might come off as like us sounding pretentiously sarcastic, but we're not. We're actually sincere in our apology.
Yes.
So sorry.
Because the art was.
No, seriously, a lot of people. We talked about this before. A lot of people have a part in creating a comic, and you know, people often focus on the artists because, you know, doing the pencils and stuff is a lot of work, but colors are important too.
Yeah, because I think we missed out a huge opportunity last week to talk about how much impact the colorists can have on the quality of art in a comic. You know, because I think there was, I don't remember who it was, somebody like a year or two ago was wondering why colorists were even got credit on the main page, or like said something about why colorists were considered real artists when pencilers did so much more work, and I'm like, not all the time, buddy. Not all the time. I mean, sometimes the colorist does do a shitty job, but sometimes they do fucking amazing, and they win Eisners, and then they still don't get credit in shitty little podcasts.
Aww.
So yeah, anyway.
I mean, inkers and letterers do a lot of work, too, so.
And it's kind of actually funny, because it's the sort of thing that you don't notice unless it's grading. Like, lettering, I think we especially take for granted. But bad lettering is the worst.
Yeah. And, well, I don't know. Well, I wanted to give an example as being the Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
But that guy won an Eisner for that lettering, so I don't know.
Well, lettering gives voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was illegible.
I'm looking at the Abyssal Plane. We have the letter that
Iori.
Yeah, that he wrote to Paulina.
Yeah.
And It lets you know that it's him. It's his letter writing voice.
Yeah,
because we see him talking it a little bit later.
You hear
like
the old Civil War voice in your head, like you're watching one of those documentaries.
What?
You know, Civil War documentaries. They always like read people's letters from the battlefield to their girlfriends. And I hear that voice.
Okay.
Whenever I read letters like this in comics, that's the voice I hear.
Okay.
And it ended up being correct because he ended up actually having been writing it to his girlfriend.
Wife, actually.
Whatever.
Wait, did they... Oh, yeah. They did get married. Did they actually marry? I think they might have.
Yeah, because when he gets the assignment, the creepy little assigner girl was like, it's your wife's birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Get on the submarine.
Russia. So, okay, let's backtrack. I'm already all over the place. Let's do the first one first. That makes sense, right?
Yes.
The order in which we read them.
The Haunted Boy.
Is that what that one's called?
I think so.
Yeah, it's called The Haunted Boy.
Look at that. Boom. Researched. And by researched, I mean I read it.
God, we're totally making ourselves look like idiots.
That's a page that I did read and you maybe didn't.
Well, this is the derpiest episode, right? So we're sticking with theme.
That.
Theme.
So what did you guys think of the first one?
Super creepy.
Yeah.
especially where evil demons, like, come out of the boy's body and like his face is stretching.
Oh yeah, when he's trying to get back into the body and he's like pulling on his lip.
that was super
creepy.
But I did like the way that it tried to connect it to your experience of the real world. So now whenever I see a kid being fucking bratty to his mother, I'm gonna think he's possessed
by an evil lake spirit.
Yeah, because this kid, like, you gotta know something's off the way he's talking to his mother. He's like, I fucking told you not to smoke in here, Mom! Get the fuck out! Jeez, Mom. I mean, apparently that was a telltale sign, you know, because it threw Abe off a little bit, and then the notepad with the dead people, he was like, something's not right here. I'll probably be back to see that boy. Let me go jump in the lake. Which, I mean, that's gotta have Abe Sapien has to have balls of steel, right? This lake is haunted, everybody's seen it, the kid died there, and he's like, well, I'm gonna go swim in this motherfucker.
It's his job,
though. It's a haunted lake,
I'm gonna go swim in this motherfucker. Thing. Like, he thinks this is boring.
Yeah.
And he actually later tells someone, I think in the next story, like, oh, you get used to it. So I don't know if he has balls of... I guess he must have
started.
I mean,
compared to me, he does.
But
I wouldn't go anywhere near that lake.
This is actually a really good example of how, like, maybe people in the BPRD, because, you know, they're real people, get, like, horribly desensitized to the things they see. But that's a good way of building character without being like, Abe Sapien was brave but desensitized to evil things.
He's seen it all.
Well, I think he has a... He has an everyday kind of quiet confidence, you know? I think having read him in these three different stories, and you get it here in the first one even, he's just like, he's not afraid of the situation, he knows he can handle himself, you know, and he just wants to go in and get the evidence and do the exploring that he has to do. And it's like, it's cut and dry for him and it needs to happen.
He's actually kind of like exemplary as a field agent because he does his background research, and he's so calm. He's not looking for any, like, action movie scenes or anything special. He's just kind of like, well, I'm going to go out here, find out what's going on, and then do a report. I really love Abe Sapien. I think he's been my favorite out of the Hellboy universe so far. So, although, when he comes in shirtless from the lake and is, like, freaking out, that felt really fake.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You didn't think that would be his actual reaction?
No. So I already felt like it was a ruse.
But he said he did that on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I know it was a ruse. It just... I didn't feel duped.
Well, maybe you're smarter than the lake demon.
I hope so.
Maybe. Well, he was trying to freak out get the parents to... He wanted everybody to freak out.
Yeah.
Because the parents weren't gonna... He wasn't gonna, like, be, okay, Mom and Dad, your son up there... Actually a corpse.
Possessed by a lake demon.
Yeah. But don't freak out. So he made it real. And then the boy turns evil. They'll never believe you. Never.
Yeah, you see the eyes change and shit.
And then he's like, a little slugger. And then he says, Grack, jerk. He says jerk, actually. He does. He's a jerk.
I like your dramatic reading of these panels. Very good.
Yeah, that's actually not even a sound effect. That comes out of his mouth.
Maybe it's a demon word.
Yeah, jerk is definitely a demon word.
Yeah.
Sounds demonish.
How did we feel about, like, the bittersweet ending?
How the moms reunited?
Yeah, and they're, like, happy and crying. Like, we moved to Maine. I guess...
Happy endings are important.
Maine seems like a nice place.
Is it happy, though? Your son's been dead for years after all. Aha!
But on the other hand, reuniting with friends, re-socializing, getting on with your life, that's important.
Yeah, because I think, like, there's this weird rift between these two women that used to be close.
Well, it's because one son died and the others didn't.
Yeah, and then you get all those feelings like, why did my son have to die when yours got to live?
She's jelly.
And then she finds out, oh, Mikey was actually dead all those years.
His son actually was made of jelly.
At that point, probably.
I mean, look at how stretchy his face became.
But I like how
that is like a twisted picture.
That, yeah, it really is. Really.
Like the way it's just clawing at the face.
You know that woman is going to need all the years of therapy. Plus, of them.
She has her friend now. It'll help.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how much of this the friend is going to buy too. Because the friend had never seen the ghost. The friend had never seen any of that.
But wait, didn't the friend, like, come to town for this?
And the mom left town because of the ghost.
Yeah.
She saw the ghost.
Yeah.
At least that's the notion I got.
The friend saw the ghost, like, three times, and I think it was she who called the BPRD.
Wait, I'm thinking of the one of the boy who died that they all knew was dead.
Oh, okay, yeah.
What are their names? Rachel's the one that smokes, right?
Yes.
Names are hard. We've only known these people for like 20 pages.
Yeah.
I just think it's going to be a weird reunion. Like, oh hey, my son was dead too. What the fuck, bitch?
I'm sure that's exactly how it's going to go down.
Are you just going to show up and that's what you're going to say?
Oh, Tina is the mom of son who died, but wasn't a demon.
How do you like the framing device of Abe Sapien's, like, mission report?
I don't remember. Let me see.
I think that's a fine way to... I mean, that's something they do with, like, police procedurals and sometimes, too. I think it's a fine framing device because they did it with X-Files in the first season. Remember all the stories were told with... ended with Scully doing her report on her ancient word processor?
I did like this, like... He ends with, it's important, however, for every agent to understand that there are many kinds of hauntings.
I think what's good about it is it makes it Abe's story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because if we didn't have Abe, like, wrapping it up for us, or making Abe the narrator, it would have been the story of these two women more than Abe.
Yeah.
Because it's a learning opportunity for Abe. As much as it is a closure for these two women and... beating the bad guy.
As much as he's jaded by his job, he still comes out of this with the renewed realization that even though it's a small job, it might not be as small as it looks.
Even though for Abe it was kind of like normal. It was kind of a normal haunting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But he did something very profound. Like, he brought closure to these two women, and they were able to reconcile and support each other over their mutual loss.
It's a really nice way to show character development without beating you over the head with it, since they only have, like, 15 pages.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, look at Abe learning things, you know?
But I was also, as much as it was useful, I was also kind of glad that it only happened in this one shot, because we read this one first, and I was like, okay, is this going to happen all the time? And then we go to the second one, it's not there, because it's a neat device to use every once in a while, but you also don't want to get, like, the Doogie Howser effect, where you wait for the lesson that the character learned at the end of every episode.
Do you know, this is, like, a total tangent, but...
It's fine.
The Doogie Howser episode I remember the most is the one where he falls asleep at the computer, and he has, like, a bunch of letters across the screen.
You know which one I remember the most? When it was on How I Met Your Mother, and he was doing the Doogie Howser, like, blog entry thing, and then the music played. nice. On How I Met Your Mother. But because it was Barney, there was like a chick in the back of the background of the show, and it was about him having had sex with all these women. It was hilarious. You should have been there.
So I think we're ready to move on to the next story. The Abyssal Plane.
This is my favorite.
This one has art by Peters. Okay, that name's hard to spell.
Skarsgård?
It's not Skarsgård at all.
Oh.
Azerbaijan?
You're just saying complicated words.
Snebjörn? I think I just butchered that in a bad way.
Sorry, Peter.
So sorry.
Sorry, Petey.
We're the worst.
Hey, that's a harder thing to research.
So this one was your favorite?
Yes, absolutely.
I like this one a lot as well.
I really liked that they managed to tie, like, kind of these two storylines together. The guy who was writing the letter and guarding the helmet was relevant.
Yeah.
The whole time. He wasn't just some dead zombie dude. He actually kind of was the protagonist of this story.
I've noticed that the BPRD stuff and the Mignolaverse stuff likes to do that. It likes to take the first page or two to set up and frame the story. And maybe not frame it on both ends, but just kind of like... And even in The Haunted Boy, the first page is about the original accident, and then you get like a 5-year time jump to Abe Sapien getting assigned the trip out there. And so here, it's not uncommon that you would get this sort of setup, you know, with Yuri and Paulina, and then time jump, story starts. Like, you kind of almost expect that to be irrelevant, those first couple pages. But then it does come back around.
Man, the scene where all those Russian bodies are, like, pouring out of the submarine.
See? That's balls of steel.
Freaky.
What I like about this story is that it kind of reminds you that, like, not every horror story has to be about, let's shoot all the zombies, you know?
This was a friendly zombie.
Yeah,
and I like how Abe used it as a learning experience for the younger agent. He's like, look, Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense. He came up here, you shot him fucking 3 times, and he still didn't attack you. He's just going to do something he needs to do, and I want to find out what the fuck's going to make him go do it. Like, don't freak out. He's not hurting anybody.
Yeah. It's almost like there wasn't an it's almost as though there wasn't an antagonist in this story. I mean, I guess they're in, well, in the, like, the bad guy sense of the word. I guess the antagonist would be the Russian government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe
really.
Maybe the sea captain a little bit. But it's
just the guy who wanted to pick a fight. The captain of the little ship that BPRD was on, or the captain of the Navy cruiser? Okay.
Because he was holding Abe back at first from going back to wherever.
Yeah. But I don't think, I still don't even think he was a bad guy. I mean, they do a good job of making him, of having the scene come up that makes him sympathetic.
Nobody is trying to prevent anyone else from doing their job. Yeah. Everybody's just doing their job in parallel.
And not, or maybe they do, but it's not in any sort of antagonistic way.
Right.
There's no malice.
Yeah. Abe's just like, look, there's a bunch of fucking dead people down there. It's like a mausoleum. I felt bad just going through it. I don't want you diving through it to look for something valuable. You know, and the other guy, and this is why this conversation was really well done, and that it comes up naturally, that it gets you to sympathize for the ship captain, too. Like, he's trying to say, I did 3 trips out here for fucking nothing. I want to get some money. I'm barely scraping by. I got a crew, I got a boat, I got to pay for gas, I got all this shit I have to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Paulina in this, and the fact that the guy is guarding the helmet not because of a sense of duty to the helmet.
But to her.
Yeah, he's just trying to finish his job so he can get back to his wife. And I feel like they interwove that narrative just right, where they give you the bits and pieces of what went down at just the right times. Like, you know, right before he dies, he's writing the letter at the very start. And then later we find out, you know, she is so sad because they just got married and he's, you know, going on a submarine. And he's like, no, I promise you, I'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
That was so sweet.
Yeah, I would say the Russians are the antagonists.
But they aren't even really, I mean, they're they're antagonists in so much that they also want the helmet. That's like as far as they're antagonizing Abe.
I'm thinking more of the creepy doll girl who makes him go out there.
But I mean, it's not her fault that the submarine sank.
Yeah, but she's like...
She seems to know.
Yeah, she seems to know. And she's just being mean.
Like she's.
I want to blame somebody, damn it.
Well, you do because sad things happen in this story.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's hard to blame anybody. I don't think it was their intention that the submarine would sink.
No, I don't think so either. I think they really didn't. I think the little stupid doll girl really did want the helmet.
Yeah.
Or what's it called? Not a burgeonette?
Yeah.
I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it. It's a French word. It's probably basse-poix-poix.
I'm sure that's not it either, Andy. You just put a B at the front and went wah, wah, wah.
Maybe, but that's what friendship sounds like to me. Yeah, we're classy.
That's just you speaking there, Andy.
I also enjoy how, like, everyone's just a little fleshed out in this. Like, the characters have just enough depth to make you wonder about them and to make them feel like real people. Like the Russian version of BPRD, their officer, he's like, I saw a ghost and it was the scariest shit ever and I want to see more ghosts. And that's like all you know about him, but it suddenly makes him from some random like Russian dude who's evilly Russian to a guy who's, you know, he's got some depth.
And you know, the good thing is that it only takes a page, you know? It fits naturally in the story. It doesn't feel like you get pulled out of it, because it only pulls you away for that one frame, you know? And this is where the art of comics really helps it out, is that frame bleeds over into the other frame. So it naturally feels like the memory he's having in that moment. So even though it pushes you backwards in time, it still happens naturally within that moment of him standing on the ship. So, the one thing I was a little disappointed with this one is that as soon as the zombie showed up, I was like, that's Yori, and he's just protecting...
I think you mean Yosef.
Yosef? Is it Yosef or Yori? I've been calling him Yori the whole time.
Yeah, it's I-O-S-I-F.
Whatever, some Russian name.
Without an R, Andy.
Yosef.
Okay. So the first time I see him up on the button, like, it's Yosef, and he's going to be going and protecting the helmet. That's all he wants to do. No, I didn't.
But it wasn't supposed to be a surprise.
Well, I like the turn. Well, the whole time they're like, I don't know what this guy is. I want to kill him and get him off the boat.
They don't know who he is, but we do. He has the same scar.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
Look at you picking up on shit.
He has the scar in all the places we see him alive. Oh. And then the zombie has the scar, too.
I didn't even notice that.
That is cool.
Whatever. I read the title page on the issue before. Or even.
You can't see it unless it's like kind of a close up on his face, but look, it's right there.
Yeah, he does have a scar there. Well, look at that.
I think at some point Abe does say, like.
Abe recognizes him.
Yeah, oh, you've been.
Pretty quick.
You've been guarding this thing, you poor dude.
But Abe doesn't. None of them know who he is.
But I mean.
But Abe recognizes what his role is.
I wasn't expecting some huge revelation, but even Abe down when he first runs into the guy in the submarine, Abe surmises what his job was. You know? Like, I mean, we get the extra bonus of getting that scene in the beginning, but we don't glean from that any more than Abe gleans from the moment he's in there. And later on, we get the whole flashback with him saying goodbye and promising to come back to his wife. And so that's a nice...
Well, yeah, we don't know why he is a zombie, and yeah. Everybody else is dead.
I mean, the initial assumption is it's out of sense of duty, because that's what Abe puts on the moment. Abe says, you were assigned here, you poor schmuck, this sucks for you, you never expected this. And then he takes the thing back away from him. And so we kind of come to that same conclusion, and so it's nice that that gets turned on us, and that we see a tender character here, where maybe... Well, I mean, we already knew he was tender, but we see that his motives down to the core come from that and not from the sense of duty that probably drive the special services officer on the Navy cruiser. Well, even him, he's not driven by duty either.
Well, he's driven by curiosity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why he's there at all. it's his job to go do it, but it's also because he's curious about the supernatural. I like this one a lot. I think this one was my favorite of the stories out of this trade as well.
I enjoy how there's no definite ending. They just have to leave the helmet and the zombie. And the last thing you see is that special sciences officer going into the sub and, like, clearly discovering something. And then Yosef holding the Bergeret.
I really did like that final panel.
Yeah.
With him, like, clutching it like a football and, like, cuddling it almost, you know? He's, like, in the fetal position with that helmet in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one. Should we talk about The Devil Does Not Jest?
Yeah. See, this one was my favorite.
I enjoyed this one a lot as well. I think, I mean, all three of the stories in here were really good.
Yeah. I will say, I love the cover to this. The coloring, like...
The covers of all these are really good.
This one, though, it's like, I really like how they managed to get a rainbow in there somehow, and it's, like, really, like, trippy, psychedelic. Strange. Very cool.
Yeah, I really like these two, just because the whole time you're reading it, you're getting the history, and you're expecting the uncle character, I don't remember his name, but you're expecting the guy who was a demonologist to have some evil thing here. You're expecting him to be the bad guy. But then he ends up just being this nice little guide. Like, oh, hey, yeah, fucked up. But hey, this is what you need. This is how you can stop her. Make sure you shoot yourself up with this, and good luck. Like, I really like it. He just shows up. It's like, oh, yeah, I fucked
up. Well, they make it sound like he's this horrible person, right? Because he, like, leaves his wife for this young bride.
Yeah, they set you up to hate him.
But then it turns out he's like, I just wanted to start my life over. Which isn't a bad thing, I guess.
No. But I really did like when you turn the page and you see the demon kind of, like, stuck in the concrete in the bottom of this house, and you're like, oh, what the fuck happened here?
Yeah. Now, I was not expecting to see a giant demon imprisoned in the basement.
Because you know the guy's a demonologist, but I don't know, I wasn't expecting anything of that level.
Yeah.
To come out of here. Even though they say you have to hate him and everything, you just didn't expect it.
This one's different from the other two, and that we get, like, a lot of action in. But it's still a cool mystery. The one thing that I felt interesting that I was when Abe first arrives at the house and he says, oh, you didn't tell me there was a lake here. And the guy says, does it matter? And he says, I hope not. But it didn't end up playing into it at all, which I thought was kind of a...
Well, because even from what we've read of Abe, we've just read Seed of Destruction, last week's story, and then this stuff and this one, but lakes are usually bad, all right? I mean, in Seed of Destruction, that house is on a lake, and there's a bunch of frog monsters in that lake. And then we get the haunted boy here, and it's just a pond, but it's really pretty deep.
And then in Plague of Frogs, he keeps having the dreams about the lake, about being underwater.
Yeah.
We don't know that it's a lake or what kind of body of water it is.
Yeah, but there's obviously some theme in his life of lakes being bad shit.
Well, I mean, he's the guy, if the lake is relevant, he's the guy that has to go in.
Yes.
Because we don't ever see any humans scuba it up.
Yeah. Yeah, and he doesn't encounter good things where he jumps into, like, scary fucking ghosts, a ship full of dead body. It's never good for him. He never, like, goes down and sees naked mermaid women.
Yeah.
You know?
I liked Hellboy's cameo in this.
Yeah.
Where he doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah.
It's nice to see them bring in, like, the hero of the series, and then let a side character take all the credit for everything.
It's great, too, because he's like, oh, you know, don't really worry about Abe. We'll go check on him, but he's alright. He knows what he's doing.
And then they get there at just the right moment, when Abe's burying the axe in the stump of that thing's head.
That was the top of its skull.
Yeah.
He pulled its head in and then cut the head off.
Yeah, because the original cut was, like, kind of, like, through the nose. Mm-hmm. And then you had to chop downward from there.
Well, that was the top of the skull. That's why it was weird. It was the top of the skull, right?
Yeah, yeah. But no, he cut off part of the head, didn't he?
Yeah, but the part that he buried the axe into was the top of the skull. It has the, like, lines. It's supposed to look like... Look at my shirt. See how my shirt has this thing on it? It's not really great for radio. I just realized that. Yeah, my shirt has a skull on it.
But that's cracked lines.
Because it's not like a skull that's been split.
I thought it was like cracked, like cut straight through it.
No, but it's solid. It's a solid bone. There's no like brain or hollow space where the brain would have been.
Yeah, it looks.
See,
like...
look. This is the only real shot where you can tell.
He kind of cut off her face, and her face was like elevated and bloated above the skull.
Okay.
That's why it kept coming at him after it's been decapitated.
Okay.
Because it wasn't really decapitated.
It was just defaced.
He took the goo off of the top of the bone.
So nasty. It also explains why she looks so derpy. I mean, if you don't have a skeletal structure under a face, that's got to be nasty.
Yeah.
Man.
Sorry.
It was...
I try to read things right.
It's an episode of corrections.
Why does the uncle viciously murder the nephew at the start? Is it just because he doesn't want people discovering the secret?
Did the uncle do it, or did the... I don't think the uncle did it at all.
I think this is Uncle Turner, because it's not... The nephew is wearing a vest or a suit or something. He looks fairly
dorky. Right, so the ghost is the grandfather.
Yeah.
Not the uncle.
Because the grandfather had one kid, and then that kid went on to have another kid, and then he left his wife and child for a grad student.
So this is the axe murderer is the son of the grad student and the grandpa.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it must have just been to try and cover it up.
Hmm. That's like such a... Why not just not invite him into your demon-infested basement? That's a thing, too.
Well, yeah, he had been... The nephew had been there before, and he had been there before also.
Is it just because of Abe Sapien?
Maybe he realized why they were there. And he's trying to cover up the family shame, or something like that. We don't really get that, because Abe blows him away immediately.
Yeah. Well, I kind of wish we knew.
That's also what the guy earlier in the story, the normal one, he was trying to say, like, the guy was so excited. This uncle of mine was so excited to have somebody to share the family secrets with. You know, and that's how he phrased it. And then now you show up with somebody who's not from the family, and maybe that's enough to...
Well, and Abe's a law enforcement figure.
Yeah. So he at this point, he's probably assuming he's going to get in some kind of trouble.
Yeah.
Which I like the way that they phrased it like that. And the way Abe presented himself, like, look... Law enforcement officer, I understand you need my gun, but seriously, I can handle myself here. Because a lot of times when you get stuff like this, I think that's one of the things that's appealing about BPRD, is so often an organization like this is like X-File, that's a bad example. I can't think of another paranormal show or something, where they're like outside of the law,
right.
Or like a secret division, like Men in Black or something, you know, like... They're not part of the government, or they're aside from the government, or something like that. But BPRD is just like, yeah, this is our division of paranormal shit.
They operate, they're a branch of the U.S. government, and they operate as such.
We train them, we give them guns, we send them out in the field, they do research and defense. Ta-da!
Well, it's like any like superhero team, right? They're vigilantes, but this is a team of superhumans, or... non-humans, in the case of Abe and Hellboy, but they are all government-sanctioned.
Yeah, and so it's a nice change to see that play out in the comic, too, where the sheriff shows up and treats him as another officer.
Mm-hmm.
Because so often, because I forgot that when I was reading, because we've only read Hellboy, BPRD, and this now, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I forgot that, and I was expecting the sheriff to be like, who the fuck are you? Why are you green? What the hell is going on here?
People are put off by it sometimes. I mean, in Haunted Boy, they were kind of taken aback.
Yeah.
She was surprised.
Yeah.
But
she's
not like...
She was like, I don't know if I want to show you to my kid, you know? And he's like, I understand the green thing's kind of rough.
I mean, it's not every day you meet a fish man.
Yeah.
So. Hmm.
But I think in this world, people are generally more open to these sorts of things because they... I mean, if the government has a division for this kind of stuff...
I think the reason probably why Abe does everything official-like, right? He calls the sheriff, he...
Says, call your dispatcher. Or I don't know if the sheriff does it, but they talk in that kind of lingo.
Mm-hmm.
As though it ain't no thing.
So, although he is not human. He acts like another professional, right? Just like a sheriff. So.
Yeah, but I really like the turn with the grandfather, just showing up and being the helpful guiding spirit, and totally not being a bad dude at all. Like they set you up to expect him to be.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was pretty bad to summon demons.
Yeah,
but it wasn't. But, he didn't want to. He got in over his head, right?
Yeah, he wasn't trying to take over the world or anything. He just was curious.
He was studying. Essentially.
Well, I mean, I can kind of relate to that drive. Like, I wanted to go out here, I wanted to start my new life, but, like, the thing that's driven me for so many years is demonology. I've been interested in it, I did it academically, you know, this was a driving force in my life, and I couldn't just give it up entirely, so I started dicking around on my own, and guess what? It was fucking stupid. And he's like, I lost my wife, and then I lost my life. You know, and I like that he has that hindsight to him even now, you know.
I really like that the sheriff survives in the end. Because you see him, like, dead on the stairs, right? And you're like, aw, that guy. And, nope, Abe rescues him.
I'm sorry, whenever you talk about the end, I just love that moment when Hellboy walks up and Abe's like, hey, what's up? This is Sheriff. What's his face? We need this medicine. And Hellboy goes, yeah, told you you'd be fine. Like, I just love, as they walk up, axe and demon skull, hey, this is Sheriff, what's his name? We need some medicine. Help us out.
The look on Abe's face in the upper right-hand panel where he's just like,
he's like, ah, damn it.
He really looks like he's so upset to have this crap in his eye. And I mean, who wouldn't be?
Yeah.
But he's so calm about it, too. I don't know, I think he's kind of reflective of how the universe is supposed to work. Because people in the Hellboy universe seem to just take it at face value that there are things like demons and, you know, Abe Sapien type dudes.
Yeah.
And they're not terribly like, it's weird to see them, but it's not freak out level weird.
Yeah.
And the way Abe just operates, like, he's a character. And the way he looks or the fact that he's a different species doesn't really define him. I enjoy that. It makes the world seem much more put together.
Well, I think also it helps that, I mean, if you're Sheriff What's-His-Face, right, and you show up and you see this fish monster, if the fish monster thing is, like, got a certain level of calm, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the calmness, that's got to be something that they train BPRD people to emanate, right? To be like, okay, you're going to be in this situation, you're going to see some weird fucking shit, and if there's a civilian around, they're going to be looking to you to hold crap together. Like, Abe Sapien cannot lose his cool in this situation. This is his field, and if he loses his cool, then the sheriff's going to lose his cool, and it's all going to go to hell from there. So I imagine they have to, like, exude that, you know? So probably if Abe weren't there, the sheriff would go, oh, fucking balls, call everybody! Call the National Guard!
Yeah. On the other hand, like, it's a very common trope. There are two common tropes in horror, or, like, supernatural drama that bother me. And the first one is when people see all this stuff all the time and they, like, somehow forget it. Like, it happens in Buffy a lot. Like, people...
Buffy's the worst.
People live in this vampire-infested town that gets attacked by everything all the time, and they're always freaked out when they see something. It's like, don't freak out because you already know vampires exist. Like, that sort of thing. The second trope is the normal authority figure who turns out to be some sort of racist hick when he sees the weird person and is like, shut up, fishman, I'm going to arrest you.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm glad they did not do that.
Yeah, neither one of those come up here. Well, we can talk about the format, too.
Oh, just a note. The monster... There's a little bit of a sketchbook at the end of the trade. It's called Momster. That's what they call it.
Which one? The demon derpy, grandmother?
Derpy grandma, yeah.
That's awesome.
There's actually something else in here I noticed in the little special features part. The girl from Abyssal Plain that assigns Yosef to the helmet, apparently she's a demon. They call her a demon.
See, I knew that bitch was evil.
I thought she was a vampire.
They describe her as the playful demon Varvara.
Ah. Maybe she comes back in some other BPRD. Yeah. That'd be cool.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe we learn more about her later.
I mean,
obviously, they take the time to name the Special Sciences Division of the Russian military and stuff. So maybe they come into play at another point. We just haven't read that.
I was figuring most of these stories are set in, you know, the 80s or earlier, because putting it back there doesn't interfere with BPRD timeline. You know, you set it far enough back, and you don't have to retcon anything. You don't have to change anything. This is all before whatever made Hellboy leave BPRD or any of that kind of stuff. This is before the Hellboy stuff even happened. You know, you throw it back far enough and it doesn't matter.
Well, no, Hellboy exists because even the last story was in the 80s.
Yeah, you know, but
and
I mean,
Sal,
like, the...
and the Professor Hellboy, Boom is alive.
The Hellboy trade.
That we read.
Seed of Destruction, I think, was the first Hellboy.
Well, right, comic. Yeah. So these are all before that, because Professor Broom's alive in these. Because he gives the assignments to Abe in the first one and the third one.
So that way you can sort of write these out-of-continuity stories, but have them not matter for continuity?
Well, I mean, BPRD in the universe has been around for a while. Because we have trades that are like 1946, 1947. So, we can assume that they've been operating at least since the Second World War.
Yeah. Okay, well, we want to rate it.
Mm-hmm.
Go first, David.
Oh, God damn it.
Okay, Jenny, go first.
4. I really liked this. It was just entertaining. I like that it was short stories. Because usually you read a trade and it's all this big thing, which, you know, it's good, but it's also... it's really nice when you're reading something that's published in serial that doesn't have to reconnect to everything else, because then they have the full time to tell the story the way they want it without having to rehash for readers or tie back in or anything. And I feel like the short story works so well for comics issues when it's well done, and I think it is well done here. It was engaging and it was a fun read. Again, like, I've said this about a few other things that we've read recently. It didn't have that, like, special something that it takes to be a 5. Like, that hard to name, like, oh my god, this is the most amazing thing ever. But it was definitely a high-quality comic, and I would certainly recommend it to any of my friends who I think would like this genre. I love the art. I liked the writing. It was just very smooth overall, and it was pleasant and fast to read.
Okay. I'll go next. I'll give it a 3.5. I mean, I really like it, but it's just... I mean, it's an above-average comic, you know, 3 is average, but I'm not sure that I do like this format. Just because it's... when you read it, it's really disjointed. And we do get to see Abe Sapien as a character out in the world, but I don't see any development happening in him. You know, aside from the Doogie Howser-esque ending of Haunted Boy, I don't really see him grow too much. Because in the second one, in Abyssal Plane, he is sort of in the mentor role, where he already knows everything. And he ends up being right. Right? So there's no lesson for him to learn there. There's no anything for him to grow. The only thing that he might have been able to grow from is finding out why Yosef decided to chase down and stay with the helmet. But so far as I can tell, it's not something Abe ever learned. That's only something maybe the Russians would know. So Abe never got that learning moment to grow there. And then in The Devil Does Not Jest, maybe he could look outside the box when it comes to the grandfather and his role in this. But I think at this point he's seasoned enough that he's just handling himself. Exactly what Hellboy says. Like, I trained him, he's fine, he's got this. And then at the end, he was fine and he had it.
Well, maybe we as readers are supposed to be... I mean, this is looking back at Abe. His past. So we as readers are supposed to be getting to know Abe. And, you know, maybe it's not about Abe learning things. It's like, look at these things Abe did and these situations that he was in, where he didn't have Hellboy, and he can handle himself. Like, Hellboy isn't the centerpiece. I mean, he is, but he wasn't always, and he's not always there to... he's not the crutch that the rest of the team needs to lean on, because when it comes right down to it, you need somebody to punch the crap out of the bad guy. And see, in this, in Devil Does Not Jest, we learn that Abe is just as capable as punching out the bad guy. In this form, the punch was an axe to the top of the head.
Brutal.
So, I mean, I enjoyed it. I just don't know that I would throw it around to be recommended, necessarily. I mean, throw around is sort of not a good word choice.
But read this comic,
But, I mean, if I were going to recommend stuff, I would recommend BPRD before this. I would recommend Hellboy before this. It's good. It just, it seems like it's already so seated in this Mignolaverse kind of world that it's hard to take out of the context.
I agree with you. I think if somebody came to me and said, man, I saw the Hellboy movies, I want to read the comics, I wouldn't give them this first.
Yeah.
But this is a good place to go if you start to get to really like the characters a lot.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad that we picked this up because we liked Abe Sapien and when we read Hellboy, and we liked Abe Sapien again when we read BPRD. And so it's a natural progression to read this one. And I like Abe Sapien here. I just think as a standalone comic, this format doesn't allow for as much growth as the longer form does.
That's fair.
So I'm 3.5.
Okay.
David.
I'm going to give it a 4, actually.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I agree with a lot of what Jen said. I'm not 100% in agreement with you, Andy. Your opinion's clearly wrong here. I like this a lot because I thought it was really strong storytelling. The art in the Mignolaverse is always really enjoyable. Like, no matter who does the inking and the coloring and the pencils, it's all really good. I mean, there's a consistent... You can see the difference between the artists. Each of them does things their own, a little bit on their own way, but the feel, the tone of the art is always the same. And I think that has a lot to do with coloring in this case, because it's always the same colorist.
Yeah.
So no matter who does the drawing, we get the same...
You get the same depth and shadow.
Because I feel like color gives a temperature, right? You know, certain colors are hotter than others. And so when we go into these places like a submarine that's at the bottom of the ocean or a house that's filled with demon animals and the monster, you know, the coloring really is what conveys the feeling of the room. Because when we have different artists like this, but a consistent colorist, you can... I mean, it feels weird saying this now because we just apologized at the beginning of the episode. But it's true. It got me thinking and realizing that, you know, when we do talk about art, we almost always only talk about the pencil work. But the rest of it it's all relevant and it all comes together to create this medium that we enjoy so much.
And I think you make a good point that what this format of having three different stories drawn by three different pencilers, you can really see the strength of a good colorist. Like, because of... There's three different styles, but they all sort of blend together. They all have a certain standard of quality to them. And you feel that it's the same universe. You feel that it's the same world, even though it's a different artist every time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the colorist is able to bring that to it. And it's in... really different ways, too. Like, you notice in Abyssal Plane when there's flashbacks to whatever the guy's name was.
Yosef?
No, not Yosef. The French dude. But there's, like, it shows him, like...
Battlefield?
Yeah, it shows him, like, on his warhorse. And whenever you do this flashback, you have this blood-red background.
Mm-hmm.
Every time. This bright, bright background. And, like, those sort of strong colors are what we really liked about BPRD. And they're here again. And it creates a, you know, this... And they were in Hellboy, too. Mike Mignola used strong colors as well. And that creates a really good coalescing thing for this universe. I just fizzled out there at the end. God damn it. It's about to make a good fucking point.
So going back to the part about the disjointed storytelling, I think maybe part of the reason that, like... I'm not trying to, like, put words in your mouth or anything, but this is... These, like, single-issue stories or two-issue stories is not how comics are told anymore, at least from the big publishers. Everything is continuity, right? Very, very seldom do we get a single issue that's a story. And so maybe we're not used to reading comics like that. Because I know back, way back when, like Golden Age and beginning of the Silver Age...
It didn't matter.
Yeah, there would be, like, one issue, it's a story. or there's a couple issues of the story, and then, like, TV often is, you know, there's Monster of the Week type episodes with the background story arc happening. And I think that's how comics used to be, but here we get that, and but in, like, Marvel and, like, Avengers, we don't see that anymore. Everything's about the event or the crossover, which has its own pros and cons, right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to knock one format.
But it's refreshing to have a mix of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think we did good.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we did a good episode?
I am pleased.
Okay. So next week we're going to read Lobster Johnson, Iron Prometheus. It's a mini-series. It's 5 issues. You can pick up the individuals if you want, but there's also a nice cool little trade that everybody got except for me. I just watched it online. Watched it, read it online. So it's, who is this one by? Also Mike Mignola. Yeah, story by Mike Mignola, art by Jason Armstrong, and colors again by Dave Stewart. He colors fucking everything for BPRD, apparently.
Oh, he does a damn good job.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to be doing next week. If you missed any of that information, you can always find it on the website, which is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com, or you can ask us directly on Gmail.
Which is atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
Or you can talk to us and correct us and tell us everything that we fucked up. Please do, because we didn't fuck it up on purpose. We just fucked it up. You can tell us that on Twitter, which is twitter.com/APSupercast. That's at APSupercast. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think most people have this problem, but don't feel bad telling us when we screwed up.
Nobody has that
problem. On the internet, because, I mean, seriously, we're trying to, we want to make a quality show, and so.
Or what you like. We like hearing that, too.
Yes, yes. You might not be able to tell by this episode, but we like quality work. If we can at all make it happen, we prefer to do that.
Well, I mean, we do this because we like, because it's fun for us.
Yeah, and hopefully it's fun for you.
Yep.
All right, then. Until next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.